think he wants to get it on the record.
That's right. I'm always afraid. Can I ask everyone please take their seats? Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this morning's workshop for the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm going to ask everyone first, if I told you to take your seats, please stand. We're going to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all very much. We have a fairly full agenda today, both on the workshop and then later on the regular meeting agenda in adopting the six-year plan. We're going to get right into our first presentation. That is a presentation by the Harrisonburg-Rockingham MPO and Dr. Carol Shepherd, who's the chairperson of the MPO Policy Committee, and Bonnie Redesel from the Central Shenandoah PDC. Good morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. We want to thank you for this opportunity to tell you a little bit about our MPO. I am Carol Shepherd. I'm the chair of the Harrisonburg-Rockingham MPO, and I also double as VP and dean at Bridgewater College. With me today is Bonnie Redesel, who is the executive at the Central Shenandoah Planning District Commission and our chief administrator, and Jennifer Hibbert, who's transportation manager for Central Shenandoah Planning District Commission, and Garrett Moore, who's with VDOT. He's the Stanton administrator. The slide you see in front of you is a nice little picture of our region in the valley. We're in the Shenandoah Valley in the northern region. We are established as an MPO in 2003. And I think that's kind of a relevant thing about our MPO. We're a relatively new MPO. We're an urban area, but a small urban area. And it wasn't until 2003 that we grew to a size that warranted having an MPO. But it also indicates one of our chief issues in our area, and that is growth. We have had astronomical growth in the area in recent years, and with that, one of the big struggles we have for the MPO is dealing with the infrastructure challenges of the new growth in the region. This tells you a little bit about our area. You can see on the map the Central Shenandoah Valley region is in green, and the little red circle is the Harrisonburg-Rockingham MPO area. It includes the city of Harrisonburg and the county of Rockingham, together with the towns of Bridgewater, the town of Dayton, and the town of Mount Crawford, all which are to the south of the city of Harrisonburg. Our population for the entire region is 76,000 with a land area of 106 square miles. And our little MPO area is also home to three institutions of higher education: Bridgewater College, James Madison University, which you see pictured there, and Eastern Mennonite University. Our area contains a variety of transportation venues. You see our roadways there. We have Interstate 81 that dominates the region. It goes right straight through the area. And also with that, 33 miles of interstate, 34 miles of U.S. highway, 39 miles of Virginia primary roads, and 443 miles of secondary urban roads. And that gives you a good flavor of the balance of the kinds of challenges we have between this vast area of secondary urban roadways and then all the way up to 81. We have some historic and scenic routes. Route 11 is the old Valley Pike, in some regions called the Lee Highway, that runs north-south through our region. Route 33 is our main artery running east-west, and it goes over into West Virginia and over the mountains to the other side, and a number of scenic byways. Public transportation, Harrisonburg Transit, you see pictured there, and we have some regional transit. The Blue Ridge County, Blue Ridge Community College Shuttle is our main transit in the county. We're home to the Shenandoah Valley Regional Airport and also the Bridgewater Air Park, which is private industry and aviation. We have some rail and freight in Norfolk Southern, Chesapeake Western, and then Shenandoah Valley Railroads, and some alternative transportations. You'll see there we have a sidewalk network, the Harrisonburg Bicycle Network, the Dayton Bridgewater Buggy Path, which you see pictured there, and our Bike the Valley program. And I want to comment a little bit on the picture you see there with the buggy path. Route 42 parallels Route 11, and it runs north-south through the region. And it is a good emblem of the challenges in the region. It is a four-lane highway with a median. Speed limit's 55 miles per hour. But it also sees a good deal of buggy traffic from the old order communities right in the Dayton area, and tractor and various kinds of agricultural vehicles all have to share the road together with bikes too. So it's a real complicated combination of transportation challenges. As I mentioned at the outset, the area has seen an incredible amount of growth in recent years. We are the Rockingham is the number one county in Virginia for agricultural sales, having 18.4% of the state total. So still a very heavy agricultural area. It is also one of the four major metropolitan areas with job growth, the others being Danville, Northern Virginia, and Lynchburg. We have an active healthcare system, and Rockingham Memorial Hospital is one of our primary employers. And you see the new facility, let me see if I can get this here pictured here, scheduled to have its big opening day on June 22nd. So we're just coming up on that big event in our area. We have two major bioscience industries, the Stanford Research Institute and Merck Laboratories. And some technology companies in Blue Ridge Data Center and Rosetta Stone, which deals with language. Rockingham County School Board is also a primary employer in our area. And on the bottom, you see the population growth I discussed earlier. Since 2000, we have the third highest growth rate of all of Virginia metropolitan areas, 13.6%. We are third behind only Northern Virginia and Winchester in growth. And that growth is both natural, we are raising up our own, and in migration. We have seen a lot of populations coming into the area to work in industries, particularly in agriculture. Education tells you a little bit about the kind of educational systems we have in our region. We have a very active school system with 14 elementary schools, 4 middle schools, 3 high schools, and a number of alternative education programs there. Also, higher education, I mentioned earlier, we have James Madison University, which has an enrollment of 18,971. These are figures from the beginning of the 2009 academic year. Bridgewater College at 1,600, and Eastern Mennonite just slightly behind that. And those, for all of those schools, that marks considerable growth. If you look at the figures for James Madison University in the first column, the growth from 2000 to 2009 is 24%. For Bridgewater College, the growth from 2000 to 2009 is 30%. And Eastern Mennonite slightly behind with 9%. We've got a number of projects going on in our MPO as a result of all this growth. How are we starting to address that? And you see here some of the studies that we've done in recent years. The city of Harrisonburg, the transit system there, has done a number of studies. One, the Rockingham Memorial Hospital route study. You can imagine, as they were looking for a site for the new hospital, the current Rockingham Memorial Hospital is right downtown. So they were looking for a site outside, and so they did a route study in conjunction with that. And the Transit Administration did a feasibility study. Also, we've been doing a lot of work with bicycle and pedestrian traffic, and we're attempting to become a region that's very friendly to bicycle and pedestrian traffic. And you see a number of studies and programs there. The Bike Valley website, it gives people routes and route pathways and recreational areas where you can do biking. Bike Like Ike is a program that's largely for college students. And you can imagine, particularly with James Madison University situated right in the center of Harrisonburg, there's an awful lot of student bike traffic. And Bike Like Ike is a bike safety program directed at college students. Walk Smart, Bike Smart, and the helmet giveaways are programs we have for the community to encourage safe bicycle transportation. And JMU has recently sponsored a no drive day in which the entire university attempts to get people to take alternative forms of transportation to work and school. We're working to develop a network of bicycle and greenways, and you see some of the elements of that listed there. We had a bicycle plan for the Shenandoah Valley in 2004, and in 2010, the Harrisonburg is working on a bicycle plan within the city. And with the MPO, we are in the process of looking at an MPO-wide bicycle network. These are some of the current studies that our MPO is involved in as we look at the challenges of our region. Our constrained long-range transportation plan, we just finished a five-year update on that long-range plan. We are involved with a south regional study at the moment. It's ongoing. The south of the city has grown a great deal, and you'll see some of the highway route systems that we're looking at in that area. The North Valley Pike Corridor, that's the Valley Pike, Route 11, that area has also seen growth north of the city. Port Republic Road Study, this was very important. The Port Republic Road is the site of the new hospital, and so there were studies done to help with traffic in and out of the hospital. We're looking at a sidewalk connectivity study. Again, we're trying to make the region very friendly to bike and pedestrian traffic. And so how can we network the resources we already have and extend those to help all of the students and people working and living in the area? And you see also the Chapter 527 TIA reviews. Those are ongoing. We've also finished some studies, and you see a number of those listed there. Very early on, we did a human services transit coordination study and a freight mobility evaluation for Harrisonburg. As you can imagine, freight movement through our region is a serious issue. With 81 right down the middle of the region, we see a lot of freight moving through, and so are there ways to use rail in conjunction with that has been an important conversation point for us. And Route 33, the access management study, this is, as I mentioned earlier, our main east-west route. It is a four-lane road with a central median, and in many ways has access points that act more like rural roads when, in fact, we need to be thinking much more about it as a major artery and looked at ways to make it a safer route. We have had a good deal of grant activity, and what you see up there, the enhancement grants are currently being considered, and I understand you're all going to be doing some of that later on today. The MPO area has these three projects up for proposal: the Dayton Beautification Project, the Harrisonburg Streetscape Project, and the Bridgewater Sidewalk Improvement Project. All of those dealing, again, with these issues of comfort and safety for pedestrians. We've also been very successful with our Safe Routes to School grants, and the three that you see mentioned there, Mountain View Elementary, Waterman Elementary, and Kaiser Elementary, have all been funded. The rideshare program is an offshoot of the Central Shenandoah Central Planning District Commission, and that offers these particular services to commuters who want to share resources in their ride to work program. And you see a number of those things listed there. This is our region, and you see Harrisonburg in the yellow right in the center. And 81, moving north to south through the region, as well as 11 and 42. Let me see if I can sort of find where my dot is. Ah, here's up on the ceiling here. So here's 81 here, and here's 11 over here. Here's 11, excuse me, and this is 42 out here. And you see listed on this map all of the projects that I have just mentioned. You can see that the projects are all throughout the region. We really are growing out from the center. And one of the things also to note is that there are three north-south routes here, but only 33, and here's 33 coming east-west. And I'm going to mention here in a moment that this is one of our primary concerns, is how to move traffic east-west through the region in a more efficient and effective pathway. So to that end, this is one of our main projects. It's the Erickson Avenue Stone Spring Road Southeast Connector. And you can see this is a smaller map here, or a larger map of a smaller area. And this is the movement here, this yellow, to move traffic around Harrisonburg, essentially 33 to 33, if you can see here. Here's 33 coming in and coming out this way. And then this would go around, kind of a beltway system around the city. This is the number one priority for Harrisonburg and Rockingham County, and the county and the city have been working together on this project to see it realized. It's a four-lane facility with curb and gutter and multimodal accommodations, so a major project, and it's designed to move east-west traffic in Harrisonburg with substantial traffic capacity and safety improvements. We really need to get people easily through the core of the area. The first phase is under construction, and little pieces of this, the Erickson Avenue end, the Stone Spring Road, and are under construction now. And the phase two contract was recently awarded, so we're moving forward with this project. And you see some of the net long-term benefits that are estimated for the project, and it is absolutely vital to the continued economic growth and population expansion, as you can imagine, as we struggle to deal with all of our growth in the area. The Port Republic Road project is another key project in our area. And Port Republic Road comes out from the center of Harrisonburg through the campus of James Madison University. A good deal of student housing is out along Port Republic Road, and then it proceeds on to the brand new hospital. And so it has been a clogged artery for us for some time. And so the expansion of that, the widening of that further into the county to accommodate the hospital has been a critical project as we move forward with the hospital. So it moves from the city into the county and is being upgraded to four lanes further all the way through with a raised curb median and a 10-foot shared use path on the west side and a five-foot sidewalk on the east side. This is essential for student traffic and for pedestrian traffic all the way out through this area. As JMU has experienced this massive growth, the student housing sort of came along to catch up. And to have access and safe access for students into the college and then on out to the hospital now is essential. The contract for the project was awarded in 2010, and we're hoping to see it completed by January 2012. And with the hospital opening here on June 22nd, it's quite important. It will improve access to the new hospital site, and there's a fire station that's just across the street from where the hospital site is. And it improves the capacity and mobility to this rapidly developing corridor. And the raised median provides access, control, and further enhancing mobility. As I mentioned with 33, as this artery grows, the amount of access to the road becomes problematic in terms of safety, so that will be very helpful. And that's what we have today. So I welcome you to ask any questions that you might have. And I will be absolutely delighted to step aside and turn to my colleagues who may know things in more detail depending on what the questions are you have.
Great. Thank you very much. Were there any questions?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Just a quick question. Just out of curiosity, on your southeast connector, what's the capacity of cars that you're expecting on that road when it's complete?
Ultimately, that would be a four-lane, and I would say controlled access. So depending on the level of service, the maximum you're going to get is about 1,500 to 2,000 per lane. So you could get an hour.
I'm not talking about capacity. How many cars are you expecting to use it?
I don't have a count with me. We might get that.
Any other questions? Ms. Pandek?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate this presentation. I would know particularly on Port Republic Road, having gotten lost out there relatively recently, that when I was growing up in Stanton, that was sort of a cart path almost. And I see now why it's so critical to improving it through the nature of that area and getting mobility and so.
There's a way in which a good deal of what our MPO is dealing with is struggling to catch up with what's already happened. You know, the growth boomed in the last 10, 20 years, and the infrastructure needs to catch up.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
this planning, this planning organization and the one in Winchester are working very effectively to catch up on things that got ahead of us for several years with the explosive growth that both communities experienced just prior to the recent recession. And anyone who visits these two areas will see that very quickly, that we have quite a bit of catching up to do to get back to the point where we can then plan for the future. If growth continues or picks back up, it would be very difficult to handle that growth effectively without careful planning.
Yeah, along those lines, can you just, what's your relationship with the universities then, particularly JMU?
James Madison University has a representative on our MPO, and we work together with them. It's essential. One of the things that makes our MPO work is that we all have to help one another. We really are the lines between responsibility are too blended. You're very quickly moving from JMU territory into Harrisonburg territory into the county territory without stopping. A student, for example, going from a class home will cross those three boundaries and back again very easily. So the university has been very involved with our MPO, and you saw a number of university projects in the presentation, and has worked fairly well with the city also in there was some rail issues and in terms of passage of rail through the campus and safe passage of that that have been worked out quite well.
Because obviously so much of what impacts, at least within that city, really is driven by whatever their development plans are.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just comment on 81 within your borders of the MPO and the PDC? I mean, are there problems with 81 in the air there or no? Is 81 a blessing or a curse there?
It's both. On one way, if we had to field all that traffic on 11, it would be a nightmare. And there are ways in which the growth in our region can be attributed to easy access off 81. And particularly, I'm from Mount Crawford. We're in the south end of the MPO region, and we're seeing a good deal of growth right at our exit. Because of the access to 81, like there's a whole new Walmart distribution center that's just gone in there. All of that can be attributed to 81. It's also a curse. There's usually not a day that goes by that we don't have an accident out there, and so our services serve 81 back and forth. So safe travel on 81 is a concern for us. And we've just had some major work done on one of the intersections to help with that, very dangerous intersection at 33. That's been has some considerable work done it, and we hope we'll see some improvement there. But 81 is it helps us immensely in getting traffic through. It also exacerbates then our issues for making sure traffic can move east to west easily.
Mr. Chairman. The situation in both Harrisonburg and Winchester almost mirror the issue of 81 in that it comes right through the center of both communities. And in Harrisonburg, the recent improvement to the 33 interchange eliminated the weaving that takes place typically at an interchange in an urban area. That's where traffic is coming onto the interstate with 65-mile-an-hour traffic in that lane. And it's a very difficult thing. And so some of those lanes have been closed to eliminate the weave, and the ramps have been lengthened to make it much easier for traffic to get on and off. But what that does, that just increases in some cases the amount of local traffic that use the interstate as a bypass from going through the downtown area. And it's true in both communities that the interchanges in the urban areas still remain problematic. And in several cases, the bridges themselves are 20 to 30 years old, and they're all in need of repair. And when we start repairing the bridges, we really need to take into consideration a redesign of the interchange. And a redesign of one of those interchanges can be anywhere, Garrett, from $30 to $50 million. Or more. And some of those are very high on the priority list for improvements in both Harrisonburg and Winchester, and even Stanton. Stanton's slightly different in that it does not go through the metropolitan area, right through the downtown area. It bypasses, Interstate 81 bypasses the downtown. But in the case of Winchester and Harrisonburg, it goes right through the center.
It goes right through the center of the city and right through the center of James Madison University. So the university itself has its own footbridge.
The same is true at Shenandoah University. It goes right through the campus there in Winchester.
Right. It's sort of interesting is that, when people talk about the issues on 81 in different places, like here, the 81 is commuter, your normal, quote-unquote, congestion issues. In other areas, it's safety or issues involving trucks.
Mr. Chairman, one of the issues of trying to come up with tolls, for instance, was in almost all these small urban areas along the valley, people use it as a bypass. And as a result, if you talk about tolling, they want to be excused from tolling for, say, a 20, 30-mile segment because that's how they get where they're going right now in most cases. But that also creates a huge safety problem for the traffic that's going straight through. And with automatic tolling today, it would be possible to exempt short runs if necessary and make it more palatable to the rural area to have tolls on the interstate.
And it really has become essential given the growth in the area to use 81.
Any other questions? Thank you for being here. Thank you very much for the presentation. And thank you all. Next is context-sensitive design. Mohammed Murshi.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, good morning. I have been asked by the commissioner to brief the board on the context-sensitive solution methodologies and our experience. I've been asked to brief the board on the concept of context-sensitive solution and also provide some information on what we have done in VDOT in the last few years on context-sensitive solution. context-sensitive design or now solution terminology was introduced to the design community in mid-1990s. Several symposiums and conferences were conducted, and the FHWA adopted a definition for CSS, which is on the monitor right there. We have adopted this definition in VDOT as a context-sensitive solution definition. A lot of people, when you talk about context-sensitive solution or context-sensitive design, a lot of people ask, what does context mean within this phrase? So I thought it's good for us to just talk about it a little bit. Basically, context means harmonizing environment, geology, topography, and balancing them with community needs and socioeconomic needs, financial viability, and other factors that is necessary to have a successful project. We had a group of folks who looked at CSS a few years ago, and we came up with some formal vision statements, which is on the monitor right here. Really, CSS is not a process. It's an attitude. We are required by law to have public participation for our projects. CSS really is going beyond that requirement to ensure that and engage the stakeholders in every aspect of a project development from inception to construction. We have adopted these vision statements and these definitions, and we have also adjusted our policies and instructions to our designers to match these visions and these definitions. Now let's talk about what is CSS methodology. How can we have a CSS, a context-sensitive solution project? There are several issues that we need to consider in order to have a context-sensitive project. Balancing safety and mobility is very important. Community is important. Incorporating appropriate and feasible aesthetics is important. Making sure that we address all of the concerns with standards is also important. Feasibility is something which we look at very carefully, and we need to make sure that all components on a design is we consider feasibility, because sometimes in some cases it could be cost prohibitive. So we have to balance all of those factors in order to be able to have a successful CSS. One of the issues that also I need to bring up is the issue of tort liability. There are some designers who are concerned about some of the factors that is being promoted by CSS, but our policies do consider risk as well as other factors. The CSS does not mean that you have to throw away the book or ignore what's been established by practitioners through many years. We feel like the way to our strategy to implement CSS, we can categorize into three big categories. One is to educate VDOT. We have, as I said, adopted the FHWA definitions. We have designated statewide champions. We have landscape architects in our staff. We've got users group, and we've got over 100 engineers who have been trained in this methodology. We've got project managers, we've got design practitioners, we've got policy managers who have gone through training to make sure that we follow the CSS methodologies in developing our plans. Engage stakeholders. Partnering with stakeholders is a very, very big issue with context-sensitive solutions, making sure that the folks who are going to be living in the area are involved from the beginning of a project to the end of the project is very important. So engaging those is really very important. We have incorporated a lot of CSS principles into our public involvement policies. Also, we have worked with the localities, and as you see later as part of my examples, to achieve these communications. Enhance the process. We have, again, like I mentioned earlier, we have incorporated a lot of policy changes into our policies to ensure that CSS is considered during the plan development process. So we have incorporated CSS in our project development process. We have provided into our forms and our other training materials sufficient information for folks to consider CSS. We have utilized innovative techniques such as roundabouts, special design training, retaining walls, special design bridge abutments, and so forth, in order to to advance the CSS methodology. We have included in our, as I said, in our forms, in our special reports, the prompts to ensure that those who are working on these are aware of the CSS methodologies. There are a lot of flexibilities in our standards. We've got the AASHTO Green Book, which most people use to design their projects. It's a very flexible guideline. We've got our 3R guidelines. We've got the subdivision street requirements. We've got access management guidelines. We've got traffic calming guidelines, rural rustic road program, scenic byway program. There are about 10 programs in the department that promotes using context-sensitive solution to deliver our projects. I guess the question is, what does CSS look like? Because we talk about methodologies, principles, visions, and all that, but at the end of the day, how do you know if you've got a context-sensitive project? What does it mean? What do we need to do to make sure that, when you look at one, how would you be able to recognize one? What I've done here, I've got some examples of how VDOT has incorporated context-sensitive solution into our projects. I think we've got 8 slides here that I'd like to share with you. First one is Route 33 in West Point, where we incorporated the town's desire to clean up and enhance the streetscape along Route 33 and crosswalks and develop parts of the town's riverfront walk, including 2 overlooks. Working with the town, we were able to accomplish these context-sensitive solution features in this project. We did have, of course, any time that you do these kind of work, you do increase the cost of your project. In this case, we did spend $715,000 to street for streetscape betterment, and the project was $143 million. So it was a very small portion of the total cost of the project. This project was completed in 2007. The next project is Monticello Avenue in Williamsburg. Again, we worked with the City of Williamsburg, College of William and Mary, and James City County for this project. All of these three entities wanted to preserve the native trees at this gateway. And we were able to go there and look at their needs and able to preserve these trees to create a entryway or gateway to the community. The cost of these additional work we did was $60,000. The total cost of the project was $2.4 million, which is about 2.5% of the total cost. This project was completed in 2008. The next example is Route 1 in Ashland. This is a gateway to the town of Ashland off of 95. The town requested the department to enhance the median of the widening project to reflect the historic character of Ashland, to act as a traffic calming device, and to provide a gateway along an otherwise benign four-lane corridor. We worked with the town and we're able to introduce what you see on the monitor here, which costs an additional $50,000 in a project that the total cost was $2.5 million. It was a 2% cost to accomplish this context-sensitive betterment. The project was completed in 2009. The next example is a retaining wall in Virginia Tech. It was built in order to maintain the viability of an adjacent hotel near the university along Route 460 in Blacksburg. And what we did here, we tried to match the hotel's stone facade and character of the area. In this project, we use a reusable form liner to simulate a natural stone facade, as you can see on the picture, to help to reduce the scale and blend the wall into the neighborhood. The cost of stone treatment in this case was $50,000, and the total cost was about $600,000. The next example is the 340 bridge projects going over Shenandoah River near Front Royal, Virginia. Again, in this project, we used some simulated natural stone finish and pre-oxidized beams. And we also designed a special railing so people can view the surrounding landscaping and the river. The project was completed in 2009. The cost of stone treatment and railing was $69,000, and the cost of the bridge was about $20 million. I'm sorry. We spent about 3.5% of the total cost in enhancing the look of the project river. Next example is Gilbert's Corner roundabout in Lambton County. This provides an entryway to Route 50 historic area between Gilbert's Corner and Middleburg, and also provides additional traffic calming measures along the corridor. We had a citizen stakeholder work group that worked with the department to come up with a lot of enhancements that we came up with, and we are building actually. Actually, we built on trying to use some of the CSS methodologies. We these roundabouts. We have four roundabouts in this project. I think you see one of them, which is to the east of the project. The project cost was $16 million. We had initially planned to put an interchange here, which interchange at the intersection of 15 and 50, which would have probably cost us close to $40 million. The project was completed in 2010. This year, actually, it's being completed. The next example is Route 634 in Prince George County. This roundabout is currently under construction. We had sufficient existing right-of-way to build a roundabout. We did not have to get a lot of right-of-way for this. We worked with Prince George and Dinwiddie Board Supervisors on this. The benefits of this was eliminating the signal cost and long-term maintenance for the signal, reducing environmental impacts of traffic setting the signalized intersection, improved safety, and we provided island for pedestrians refuge. The total cost of this is $2.7 million. The project's estimated construction completion is August of 2010. The last example I have for you is Route 615 Ironbound Road in Williamsburg and James City County, Street Escape and Boy Retention Basin. This project we are improving a major street from 2 to 4 lane with raised landscape median. We incorporated in this project linear bio retention basins along the after right of way for water quality and quantity. As you all are aware, in order for us to meet the stormwater regulation, a lot of times we have to go and purchase additional right of way and try to take care of the runoff that we create from our new roadways. This was a very economic way for us to do that and also try to enhance the beauty of the landscape in the area. We also have a multi-use path in this project. The cost of landscape and bio retention betterment was about $314,000, which is about 3% of the total cost. In order for us to really be successful in implementing CSS, there are four major factors. One is we need to make sure that community participates in project development process. As I mentioned earlier, we do have public participation processes by law, but going beyond that and making sure that the stakeholders and the customers, local customers, do have a say from the beginning of the project to the end of the project. That's really the key to succeed in having these kind of projects, or any project, actually. Environmental compatibility. The project needs to be in harmony with nature and human environment. Engineering functionality and safety. Again, we should not and we will not compromise safety and mobility when we develop these projects. And the last item is financial stewardship and feasibility. We need to make sure that what's been proposed is reasonable, is cost-effective, and is in the best interest of all of us. Mr. Chairman, that's all I've got. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schwartz first, then Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in my view, the single most important thing that Muhammad said in his presentation was that the triad of roundabouts at Gilbert's Corner cost $15 million instead of $40 or possibly $50 million for the interchange that was programmed otherwise to be built there. CSS is not about a bunch of tree huggers putting trees along highways. CSS is potentially, and this is what I think is very important to be emphasized, one of the most important fiscal tools that we have as a board that VDOT has to control costs in a funding-constrained environment where we have a lot to do in terms of getting people from one place to another and not enough money to do it. From my perspective, CSS, while it can be about aesthetics and landscaping, is for our purposes most importantly about scale and scope, about designing projects of the least necessary scale and scope to get the people from one place to another, because the least scale and scope will mean the least cost. And so I don't want there to be left any impression that CSS is necessarily a cost add-on to the typical project. If CSS analysis is properly done, in my view, it can address very on at the conceptual stage scope and scale issues that can result in significantly smaller projects, less expensive projects that do the same job. Mohammed also mentioned what he described as a high level of flexibility within the AASHTO rules and regulations. I can tell you that time and time again over the years in projects that I have been involved in at the planning stage, AASHTO has always been waived as the single reason why the Commonwealth essentially couldn't adopt CSS-type solutions, because the rules were the rules. And I have always suspected that there was way more flexibility in AASHTO than was typically described. And I think that's the case, and Mohammed is mentioning that. This is not a process that should be initiated with citizen participation, though that's obviously an important part of the process. CSS is something that should be initiated internally at the earliest stages of analysis of the of essentially all of the projects that we undertake. I think that there is the potential over time for literally billions of dollars of savings in transportation investment if we would look to CSS principles guide us toward appropriately scaled projects that still do the work. And I do not think that we have done the job within VDOT, within the culture of transportation in Virginia, to get that point across, to get the necessary training across, and to get the message out that this is valued. The flip side of this is that VDOT's very much involved in the dialogue when private sector developers, corporations who may be moving here, whatever, are submitting their plans to local authorities for particular projects that have significant economic development implications. If we want to say that we are economic development friendly and want to encourage business investment in areas where it ought to be encouraged, one of the best things we could do is make sure that the culture and the values of CSS are part of VDOT's analysis as to the necessary road improvement requirements that go with these private sector investments. I will tell you that my observation is at the district level, to the extent I have seen it, is that folks out in the districts are not doing this, and that VDOT's comments reactions to private sector applications still tend to be overkill type solutions that simply increase cost and drive down the return on investment. So from the perspective of both the Commonwealth and from the perspective of the businesses we're trying to encourage to invest here, I can't emphasize strongly enough the importance of CSS, not so much as an aesthetic tool, though that's nice, but as a fiscal tool, and I think that's the way that this board going forward ought to approach it. Thank you.
You want to respond to any of that, or Mr. World?
I guess Gilbert's Corner was a good example that you mentioned, and I think, you know, you need to look at the context of the project before really you can make that determination if it's going to save us money or not. There are some projects like Gilbert's Corner who have yield some benefits, but I guess the question here is, are we getting the same thing from both alternatives? You know, an interchange moves a lot more traffic than a roundabout. But again, every project is unique, and you need to look at it. And there are going to be some folks who may want to suggest a roundabout on an intersection might not be the best technical solution to it. So we need to look at them individually. So I don't disagree with you that it could help us, but I think we need to look at each of them individually before you make that decision.
Mr. Worley.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a good point, and I do think we need to emphasize the CSS in our early in our development process. I know that we do have some procedures out there, but I can't say that we are really using them to the fullest extent, and what we will do is work with staff to try to figure out how we make that, again, become more of the culture of the organization.
Well, and I'm going to go to Mr. Martin in a moment, but I do have to tell you from personal experience in dealing on these issues, it's who raises this. It's usually the community or the developer who raises CSS, doesn't call it that, but they ask for certain things to in the design because of community interests. It's not VDOT that raises it. And the question is that, I mean, really the issue for us is how do we start to ingrain this into what we do from the get-go? I mean, because we've got some god-awful, ugly structures out there. And, you know, one thing I would love for you to figure out, how do we make those really, really disgusting-looking sound walls look better out there, which are just ugly, you know, they're like gigantic billboards everywhere. So we spent all these years and time getting rid of billboards, and now we replaced them with continuous 40-foot-high structures. But that's just me speaking.
No, it's interesting.
But, I mean, no offense taken. But, I mean, when you look at some of the structures, I mean, unfortunately, and I recognize that how much, though, can we do? We get ash tow when you look at federal highway requirements for us as well. Because they make us do dumb things. Like Ms. Pandak and I can point to this one in Prince William County, Occoquan. We built a beautiful bridge over the Occoquan River and then put this ugly sound wall on it. I mean, spent all this time and effort designing a bridge that really was going to be a beautiful structure for people to look at, and then put a partial sound wall that went one third of the way across. And, you know, and it's because the Federal Highway Administration had its requirements that made us do it. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schwartz's question and the responses have overlapped enough that I can be much briefer. going back to slide 5, CSS methodology, bullet 4, when addressing concerns for deviations from standard, from established standard, I heartily recommend that you make a guiding principle of whenever that happens, clearly delineating the objectively and measurably reason for the established principle, and then either showing how the deviation accomplishes the same thing or acknowledging why it's okay not to do it. And obviously that helps preempt the tort liability, but I see a definite added value there in that what almost certainly will happen over time is discovering some of the established standards have maybe morphed into paradigms more than serving a purpose, and then someone actually doing what's necessary to keep up with technology or attitudes or whatever, but that the new established practices actually reflect what is more CSS friendly and more efficient and effective for today?
Well, I think our policies, our standards are very flexible. We do have processes in place for those kind of conditions. If you cannot meet the minimum requirement, we have a process that you go through, and it's called design exception process, where in order to make sure that we hold the Commonwealth interest, all of those design exceptions we'll look at it. It goes through one individual in the state who will look at it, and most of the times these design exceptions are approved, and they can go ahead and continue with the design below standards. So we have a process to use it, and we use it every day. A good example of it is hot lanes in Northern Virginia. You know, we have to build so much in such a constrained right away, and we have to use those methodologies to be able to build the roadway. So I don't think that our, again, I kind of am the owner of the policies, and I know you may think I'm biased, but I think the policies are flexible. We have a lot of flexibility. We said minimums, and if there is any project manager who wishes to go below that, then we have a process. They go through, and then we look at it to make sure that all T's have been crossed and I's have been dotted, and then we'll tell them, go ahead. It makes sense. You have objectively looked at it. You have got good reasoning behind what you want to do, and we'll let them do it. But I think we need to be careful setting bars too low, and that's why we have adopted ASHTO's standards, which is nationally accepted throughout this nation. But we do have processes. I guess that's what I'm telling you, is we have processes in our books that allows people to developers, our own VDOT designers, to go through a design exception process and go below what's usually practiced.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Bowie. I certainly like Mr. Schwartz's suggestion of trimming down, not overkilling, but all but one of these examples of what CSS would look like appear to me to be aesthetic add-ons. How should we reconcile the CSS attitude on the one hand, when on the other hand we have virtually eliminated flower plantings along the highways, especially interstates? We have greatly reduced the mowing along highways, especially interstates. How do we reconcile those two approaches?
I cannot answer that question
carefully.
Yeah, everybody.
Yes.
I agree with what Mr. Schwartz was saying in terms of the roundabouts, and I love them aesthetically. I think they're great from that perspective. But oftentimes, whenever they've come up, I've gotten from the engineers, they can't work because of either traffic flow or because of the type of traffic, truck traffic, things of that nature, that it's too constraining and creates that. When do they make sense? When don't they? You yourself mentioned that you get more traffic flow through an intersection than you do through a roundabout.
An interchange, not an intersection.
An interchange. Okay. Can you give us an idea? What are the standards that we should be looking at where a roundabout makes sense, where an intersection makes sense, where an interchange makes sense, so that we've at least got, or VDOT's got, some kind of idea of where this can be incorporated into a plan versus when it shouldn't be a factor?
We have, we have roundabout policy in place, which we'll get into details of that. Roundabouts are new in the United States. They're used a lot in Europe.
Yeah,
and in most cases, they're very efficient for low volume roadways. Now, if you want to have two interstate highways, of course you do not want to put a roundabout. But up to 20 to 25,000 cars per day, the literature that I've read indicates that probably is feasible to use roundabouts. Now, you have one lane or two lane. There's a lot of different factors you have to look at. We do look at trucks when we design these things. We want to make sure that we can accommodate emergency vehicles, fire trucks, ambulances. Those are the issues that
the designer's struggle between the design. You know, it's good to design a little tiny something, but again, you have to accommodate all the users. And we do have all of those factored into our policies. And if I don't know, if you read our you know, road design manual and other publications we've got, we do have we have all of those included in how we go about to design something.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Panik.
I appreciate Mr. Mashai coming, the commissioner, putting on, and you putting him on the agenda. You tasked our subcommittee on the Route 29 corridor with dealing with some rather thorny problems generally along the corridor, but also with particularly Buckland area and Charlottesville area. And so we have sort of been wondering about what's possible. I happen to be out in northern Arizona up in the Red Rock Sedona area near the Grand Canyon, and there's a new road in there that they've done to address their concern about dealing with bringing in the tourists at the same time not destroying the environment. So it was a hugely economic development issue for them, and that's where I first saw something that looked to me like, oh my gosh, you can build a road to fit the topography, you can build it so it blends in, and came back and said that, and Mr. Rasnick said, and sort of, we can do that at VDOT, and that's how Mr. Mashari came to us, and I think we kind of thought it was important as the subcommittee to remove the bushel from the light that apparently is in VDOT on this, and let, you know, everybody know that there are lots of different options. They may not just be a roundabout, and you will recall Prince William had the first roundabout, and we kind of had to fight tooth and nail to get it. But that it's a different VDOT that actually is looking at these issues, and they're going to vary depending on what the particular problem is, but they may help us through the solutions, and they also fit the economic development. They fit, as Mr. Swartz said, budget issues. And they fit the V-Trans goals of dealing with the environment in addition to mobility. So, thank you.
Any other questions? Get to work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Revenue sharing applications. Mr. Estes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Get this fired up here. All right, I've got just three slides I want to go over real briefly with the board. And this basically came up last month when we were discussing the six-year program and the next budget, and there was discussion of where we stood on the revenue sharing applications for FY11. And just a quick overview of the background for revenue sharing program again. It's basically a 50-50 match program set in law where locals put up a dollar and VDOT puts up a dollar to match that. As again, the point of discussion last month was about the allocation limit for this coming fiscal year at $15 million of state funds, whereas the past few years we've had, when we've added the bond proceeds, we've had up to $50 million in state funds matched by at least $50 million in local money. Again, the program's open up to all counties as well as the cities and towns who operate and maintain their infrastructure. That's the 81 in the urban system, and the deadline is this Friday. We'll talk really briefly about kind of where we stand with that. It's important to note that the maximum that the locals can ask for is $1 million on their end to be matched by $1 million from us. And a critical point is the new tier system, or not new, but fully implemented, I guess, this year is what we'd say. And as a reminder to the board, those four tiers that are in place by law gives priority to the local administration of projects. And you can see the next three below that. So here's where we are as of the end of last week. Where you can see, we broke this down by district, where out of the, I think it's 176 localities that can participate, you see the 56 there that have indicated interest. Again, this is based on Friday's deadline. You can see it broken down. But the real number is the close to $41 million in requests against the 15 that we have available. We'll break that down for you a little further on the next table. And you can see this kind of broken down by the towns who are eligible, as well as the cities and the counties. And where we track, what we did is we took a look at the last 2 years compared to this year. Back in '09, the board allocated $49 million in state funds. Last year, the requests were down to around $40 million, and it's hovering around that dollar amount this year. Critical piece to pull out of this slide is at the very bottom. When you look at those four tiers, again, what we've got right now, tentatively, is $33 million in requests for Tier 1. Again, that's the counties, cities, and towns who are willing to locally administer those contracts, with $15 million available. So you can see that hovers around 45% availability for those projects. So if a county asks for $1 million, they're willing to locally administer a project or two out of that $1 million, they're going to get around $450,000 this year. The more important part to that is for you that represent localities that are in that next list, in Tier 2 through 4. Right now, there's about 11 localities in that area out of the 56. Based on the current budget amount, we'll get zero allocations for revenue sharing funds in FY11. And just as a side note, the reason these numbers are going to fluctuate a little bit is based on some of the discussions we've had with localities over the last few weeks. Again, reiterating, we've been reiterating this for months now, that there's a $15 million ceiling, it looks like, this year. There's been a movement to try to get, from a local perspective, more projects and more locals up into Tier 1. So that 45% number, I think, is going to go down even further if we go with the $15 million, based on, again, some locals kind of last minute trying to say, well, yes, I'm willing to locally administer it if it means I'll get at least a little bit of money. I just bluntly put that on the table for you, and that's your quick update with where we stand. I do just want to kind of get in front of one question I'm sure we'll hear. Ms. Pusher, who's going to be up here in a minute talking about the budget six-year program, is going to address a little bit of our game plan from VDOT's perspective about what we may or may not be able to do with the $15 million limit, but that's your update. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Ms. Estes. Any questions? Great. Thank you. Next is the combined six-year improvement plan and VDOT annual budget. And we have Rita Pusher and Connie Sorrell from VDOT.
Mr. Chairman, is this the same presentation we set through a couple hours individually on teleconference the last few
days? We're concerned that you might not have gotten it all.
Okay.
All right. No, it's yes, it is. So we want to just very quickly go through it for our viewing audience, and then is that okay or no?
Yes, sir.
Let's just go through it quickly.
Well, you all know that the presentation includes highlights of the 11 through 16 six-year financial plan for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund. Then we'll focus on the fiscal year 11 budget for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund. We'll narrow down further to the VDOT budget and our Highway Six-Year Improvement Program final proposed plan. This slide, which I'll just briefly indicate, this is just a reiteration of the CTB's requirements related to allocating funds. One of the unique parts of this is that we do allocate a portion of the TTF to the port and the airport and mass transit. The six-year financial plan for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund is estimated at $23 billion for fiscal years 11 through 16. And the fiscal year 11 component of that six-year plan is the 2011 budget that we'll be discussing. In comparison to the last two six-year plans for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund, with 11 through 16 at $23 billion, that compares to the 10 through 15 plan at $22.5 billion and 9 through 14 plan at $24.4 billion. As you'll recall, even though we made a significant reduction in our state revenue picture in the 9 through 14, we did cut an additional $1 billion in the 10 through 15 plan. This six-year plan is based on the December 9 official state revenue forecast. We have not had an update to that forecast. We anticipate receiving one through the normal budget process in November timeframe. And state revenues do represent approximately 70% of the Commonwealth Transportation Fund revenue. I'll talk about the federal revenue picture in more detail in a slide further along. This is the six-year peer perspective of the $23 billion total. It shows the revenue, state revenues and federal revenues by year, and does highlight the use of capital improvement bonds in the line item about two-thirds down the page. These are the proceeds that we will be using for transit and public transportation and to match federal dollars for the highway program. This is just a bar graph depicting the revenue sources for the six-year financial plan of the CTF, showing the federal component and the bond component on either end, and the distribution in the middle of the state revenues, and distinguishing what portion of those are used through the TTF or construction fund and the balance to the HMOF. The next slide shows over the 6 years the estimated allocations for the six-year financial plan. As you can see, debt service over the 6 years, which does include the proposed bond issuances of the CPR bonds for each of those years, totaling $1.6 billion. Highway maintenance at $11 billion for the 6 years. Public transportation and rail does include the allocation to the ports and aviation, and actually the port is about, of that $54 million a year, a $33 million is for the port and the balance to aviation. And then the two items, earmarks and special financing, combined with the highway system construction category, is the construction component of the Commonwealth Transportation Fund six-year plan. Graphically, it looks like this. Highlights are that 48% of this six-year plan goes to highway maintenance, or as I indicated, about $11.2 billion over the 6 years. 22%, or approximately $5 billion, is for the construction program when you combine, again, both the earmarks and the highway system construction pieces of the pie. And debt service at $1.6 billion for the 6 years equates to 7% of the CTF revenue picture. To narrow down the focus to the fiscal year 11 budget of the CTF, graphically, this shows that the fiscal year 11 revenue picture is $3.74 billion. It is down slightly from the revised 10 budget. You can see the components, the TTF at approximately 22%. We do segregate the component of the PTF at 4%, which is where we accumulate interest earnings and insurance premiums to use for debt service payment. Payments each year. The next slide is again the allocation component of the fiscal year 11 budget for the CTF. Again, the largest share is maintenance at 46%, construction at approximately 26%. One highlight, additional highlight, is the operation tools and admin portion of this budget. Last year it was 11% of the total. This year is 9%. That does have to do with the reorganization and the layoffs from the process, the blueprint process that has been implemented over the last 18 months. To narrow the focus again of the $3.7 billion budget, fiscal year 11 budget for the CTF. VDOT's 2011 budget is $3.3 billion of that. It is down slightly from the FY10 budget. If you take out a couple of the components or look at what we've reduced in terms of use of CPR bonds and eliminate the transfer for the Dulles Toll Road, it is comparable to the 10 fiscal year 10 budget. One thing I wanted to indicate, we have set aside approximately $12 million for a potential employee bonus. I believe you may have seen that discussion in the newspaper recently where It looks like the state general fund may generate a small surplus, and there was a legislation that if that was the case at a certain level, that state employees would look at approximately a 3% bonus in December. Unfortunately, VDOT does not share in that general fund money, and we've had to use our state money to accommodate that, but we felt that was important. And 11 is continuing the component of the state construction program where we are unable to allocate state funding through the construction formula for primary, secondary, and urban. This shows the resource breakout for the VDOT component of the budget, and it shows the tax revenue and federal revenue as it's used for the construction fund programs and the HMOF programs. As you can see on this slide, and Connie will discuss this in a little bit more detail in a few minutes, there's $511 million of the construction state construction funding that we are transferring to the HMOF to bring that total program or fund budget to $1,844,000,000. On the VDOT program side, we like to show this slide, and we're comparing the 11 budget to the 10 revised. It does identify all the funding programs, including our environmental planning, construction, maintenance, the financial assistance we give to localities for maintenance, administrative and support services, and again, you can see in that category an $18 million difference. Total overall compared to the revised 10, we're down about $54 million. I'll get you the construction allocation discussion with the Highway 6-Year Improvement Program in a moment. Connie will touch on maintenance in a little bit more detail and talk about how her maintenance budget ties to the needs assessment. And I have mentioned the reduction in the administration and support services, which has gone down about 8%. And, again, I'll discuss now some of the uncertainty in the federal funding levels. The six-year improvement program has changed just slightly from the May presentation. The $5.7 billion for highway came in May at $5.6 billion, but what we have added to the program is the confirmed additional allocation for STP funding and safety funding from federal highways. When they did the continuing resolution for funding for federal fiscal year 10 that carries through December, we found out that we would have a little bit more funding in those areas, so we have programmed those between May and June. But really a nominal change at this point. The principles in the next discussion on this slide are the same as we discussed in May. I'll just let you read those. And same with the actions, a summary of the actions that we have taken in the six-year improvement program since we started the reduction of state revenues in June 2008. Those have not changed from last month's presentation. The Federal Revenue Reserve. When we got a word of the continuing resolution of Safety Lou through December 2010, what that gave us was a solid information on our fiscal year 10 federal funding. And as you know, we started a Federal Revenue Reserve in fiscal year 10 to prevent us from over-programming federal dollars without a solid indication of what our funding would be from that federal program. With the continuing resolution, we were actually able to free up the fiscal year 10 reserve of about $103 million and program. What that means is we were able to program those dollars with the federal revenue confirmation. But that has we're not able to eliminate the comfort of that Federal Revenue Reserve for 11 through 16. So we still do have approximately $600 million over the 6 years unprogrammed just in case those revenues don't materialize. But we are looking at that on a year-by-year basis. We hope to have better news about that. Hopefully in the November-December time frame, I hope they don't go up to the last minute on another continuing resolution. Freeing up that $103 million, as I had indicated in May, we did put funding to the remainder of the ARRA contingency projects to make sure that those projects that you approved as for ARRA funding, that we were able to get those done. We put some project development costs to the Midtown Tunnel, put some funding on the 164 Median Rail project that's being administered by the Virginia Port Authority, and the release of those funds will mean a little bit of additional enhancement funding, which you'll be able to work into your next project selection process with Mike Estes, and it'll give the MPOs a little bit more CMAQ and RSD money that they'll program this year. In the out year in 2016, when we added that, we dropped 10 and added 16 in the 11 through 16 program, we did concentrate on deficient bridges on the interstate and primary and put a good chunk of money on the deficient bridges in the out years, and we added interstate and primary paving projects of a reconstructive nature, and Connie will talk about that a little bit more in her update. We had also mentioned we were trying to make sure our safety or HSIP federal funding gets moving. Some of that has been sitting on projects for a while, so we're working with locally administered safety projects, VDOT administered safety projects, and looking at some STAR program projects that are being developed by planning, transportation planning, and trying to use those projects for speed up the implementation of some safety projects. We are looking at CMAQ funds that are sitting at the MPO level and trying to get those moving forward, and we do have an option of pulling those funds back and centrally programming them if we feel that need, and looking at the 2012 update. I guess other highlights, very simply, no project cuts at this point, trying to keep all the projects that we have going forward as the schedules dictate those coming online. We did, in fact, sell $500 million in bonds to use as match and to fund the rail and public transit projects. We did put some additional funding on the I-64 NEPA study from the Richmond to Hampton Roads, that corridor, and we put funding on I-66 for a multimodal study. When those spot improvements can be funded, we'll be ready to go on that. I know there is some MPO discussion on that has to happen going forward. The next slide you all see, normally it's just a depiction by system of the $5.7 billion, and this, as I said, only changed slightly. But the thing I think that you may be interested in is what we are looking at, what we're watching, and how these things will impact the update of the program for the 12 through 17 program. And Mike indicated I'd be speaking to revenue sharing, and this is where I'll talk about that briefly. We hope to know where we'll be with another continuing resolution for fiscal year 11 from the perspective of programming an additional year of Federal Revenue Reserve. We would hopefully know more about that in the November-December time frame. At that time, we'd also like to review what we would do with the CPR bonds for the next issue. We plan to issue those bonds every year through this six-year program, that's the plan. The state's debt capacity incorporates that plan. Would we look to put some of that on PPTA projects? Would we want to try to do more with deficient bridges? But during that same time frame, when we'll know hopefully about the federal continuing resolution, and at the same time the state will be doing a formal update of state revenues through the Department of Taxation. So I think we have a decision point in the December-January time frame of what we can do going forward. The newspaper and the Secretary of Finance is reporting, general fund revenues are at estimates right now. It's good. That's good news. Even though May there was a slight tick down in retail sales and some revenues, they are still at the estimate. It wasn't as good as they had hoped, but they're saying positive things about the revenue picture at this point. So again, in the November-December time frame, we want to talk about what we could do if they changed our revenue picture for the next 6 years. Look at deficient pavements, look at the revenue sharing, doing something with that program going forward. At this point, not a lot that I would propose doing in 11, but I definitely we want to look at that for 12 forward and see if this gives us any movement on our ability to put state funding in the construction state formula for unpaved roads, primary, secondary, and urban construction. So I think we've got some things that we can look at, and I'd like to think we might be able to do a little bit more with the updated revenues, but I just don't know yet. And that's it in a nutshell.
Any questions, Ms. Buescher? Yes, Ms. McCarthy.
Ms. Buescher, I just want to clarify something. I may have asked you this the other day. I don't remember, but on your next to last slide, page 27,
mm-hmm.
you have primary, secondary, and urban funds allocated for $1.8 billion. Is that state money? I thought we didn't have any money to distribute through the formula.
Which slide are you on? I'm sorry.
Page 27, next to last.
This is federal money.
Federal money.
Oh. We get federal IM for interstate maintenance. We get the RSTP, CMAQ, NHS funding. We get SCP funding, bridge federal funding that we use on the different systems. There is some federal maintenance projects in here as well from federal funding.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I think it's necessary to say a couple of things. I applaud staff for all the work that's been done, the way it's been done, focusing on maintenance and the federal match, which are basically legislatively required. And this is not district-focused. This is more a statewide concern and comment that I share, and that is that there is in this budget plan a major shift of money away from secondary and urban roads in the Commonwealth to the urban areas, mainly because, as was explained, concrete-based primary roads that need to be rebuilt as opposed to just repaved. There's also the elimination of any funding for construction of secondary urban-type roads in this budget, and revenue sharing basically goes away. And to me, when you look at secondary roads that are already 30% deficient in paving, and we're aiming for 18% for interstate, primary, and other roads, there's not a proper balance there, in my view, in the budget. And somehow or another, we need to seek a better balance. And I know what we're trying to achieve and what we're legislatively mandated to do, but I don't think we've made the right choices by zeroing out secondary urban roads in this budget. And I would love to see some consideration of that, as tough as it would be to find a way to deal with it.
Yes.
A follow-up point to that. The $500 million transfer from construction to maintenance, is that, how is that arrived at? In other words, did you say that's what we need in maintenance? Is it statutorily required, or is it something, it's a balancing act between federal match and maintenance?
Mr. Lane, Mr. Chairman, it is somewhat of a balancing act. The Appropriation Act deems maintenance first. One of the assumptions in developing the budget and the six-year program is growing maintenance at approximately 4%. And that includes the maintenance payments to localities. So we are starting with the previous year, growing it by 4%. That takes additional state revenue than is available in the HMOF. So we move the only other source of the state revenue from the TTF into the HMOF and to achieve that growth rate. That does not meet the needs as identified by our needs assessment, which Connie will talk about. But we have also, in fact, in the construction program, eliminated all state dollars that we could. In other words, I can't match the interstate federal maintenance funding that we get with bonds because it's maintenance. So we use state dollars there. For MPOs, their allocations, a few years back, we agreed to provide them matched RSCP and CMAC funding that we distribute to them, which is federal funding, that we match that with state dollars. So other than that, the state dollars that we can eliminate from construction, we've done that. And we've also moved $155 million for the fiscal year 11 maintenance budget from the federal allocation that might have gone to the construction program into maintenance to fund those things that would qualify for federal reimbursement. So that's all the state revenue we have.
Right.
We made the combined choice to provide a certain level of growth in maintenance and accommodated the movement of state dollars to handle that.
So in effect, we can't move any more money, because if you take more money from there, you don't have money to replace it. In other words, sure. Back to Dave's point.
Mr. Chairman, there is some flexibility, but it's not easy. An example, instead of 4%, maybe 3%, and have some money left that could go to secondary road considerations. There are a lot of tough choices in the budget, and as I said at the beginning, I applaud the work that's been done, but I really am concerned about the trend I see happening, and I do not believe the Commonwealth will be happy in a few more years when secondary road deficiencies get up to 50, 60%, and we have to start totally rebuilding roads instead of trying to maintain them.
I think we're saying the same thing, and that's where I'm coming from, is that it didn't seem to me our requirements, it first said maintenance. It didn't say then try to allocate to get to the match. It says maintenance first. So that's really where my point was coming from, Dr. Davis, and agreeing with you.
I think the bottom line problem, there's two problems. One is obviously the amount of resources going into the system. But the immediate problem is that under the law, our three top priorities are debt service, maintenance, and federal match. So our entire, particularly highway program, has now become driven towards the federal program. Whatever resources we have, really, it's that we essentially have been co-opted by, I'm going to say, federal priorities and programs. So when you get through those top three, there is not that much money left over, and until those priorities, or at least we get more flexibility in dealing with those priorities, we're going to continue down this road because it is statutorily based. Is that right?
Yes. It's in the Appropriation
Act. Mr.
Kulabai. Mr. Chairman, one of my colleagues responded to this briefing by saying, good budgeting, not so good management. In other words, we can make the numbers work for budget purposes, but clearly the shortcomings that are being pointed out are still there. I think Mr. Lane is onto something. We have we've not faced this as directly as we should. The fact is, if maintenance is a priority, we're actually making other things a higher priority than maintenance because we're arbitrarily assigning $511 million to maintenance when we know, and we're about to get a briefing that shows, the maintenance needs are much, much higher than that. In fact, if we were honest with ourselves as a board, we would have to say we can't actually meet our maintenance commitment, even though that is the legal priority. Now, we've assigned a number to it, 4% growth a year, and that works for budgeting purposes. But I'll just have to say it directly. It's basically dishonest. Now, this is not a problem that any of us caused. It's not a problem that the current administration is responsible for in terms of making it happen. But it's something that, as a board, we've really got to face. The other part of this briefing is that the revenue sources that support the transportation program in the Commonwealth, long, slow recovery, I believe, is the word that you used in our briefing, which means this does not get better month by month. In fact, Ms. Buescher says it has the potential to get worse when there's no factors we still don't control, what the federal government will do, what our own revenue estimates will show, what decisions the market will make about our ability to sell bonds and so forth. I have to admit, this is beginning to bother me a lot, and not just because pavement deficiencies in Northern Virginia are over 40%, not 30% of the state average. It's actually higher. And yet what we really need is additional capacity. Instead, what you say is exactly true. We're beating the existing lane miles we have to death, and the cost of rebuilding as opposed to repair or rehabilitation is huge. We're doing exactly the opposite things by default that we should be doing given our understanding of the paucity of resources that are going to continue for some time. So I don't know what to do about it, which is frustrating. You can't, voting against this budget or attempting to move all the construction money into the, you know, canceling contracts, you know, they're just not very good options here. But I just have to say I think we're being basically dishonest now about that maintenance priority. And to me, that should be the single highest point of focus as we look for remedies, whether it's in the General Assembly or elsewhere.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Banda.
I agree with all of my colleagues, but I'm not sure I agree with their ultimate determination that it's a question of balance or that we need to give even more money to the maintenance program. We've taken it from construction in order to get the type of highway system that we need to make this state continue to be an economic engine, that we need to have a quality of life. I mean, that, you know, when I get on the road and I predict it's going to take me an hour and I spend 4 hours, that's 3 hours I can't bill as a lawyer. And heaven forbid that I had an ice company in which I had the ice sitting there. It is killing our businesses on a daily basis. It is killing our family life because instead of my dad being home in 7 minutes, you know, it would now be 3 hours perhaps. And so we have these hidden costs that are being generated by the fact that, bottom line, the problem is not one of balance. The problem is insufficient resources. And while we might, I think you're correct, Mr. Secretary, we need some flexibility with the federal program, we also need the money to build the roads as a supplement. And what I told Ms. Buescher after she gave us our very thorough presentation was, I'm very confident about the way VDOT goes through and does budgeting. I am thrilled that we are on time and on budget on projects. But when I listened to the end of the presentation, I looked at about 6 inches of material that had zeros at the end of most of all the projects in the out years. My conclusion was that the presentation doesn't emphasize the basic problem that there is not enough money. And absent some additional sustainable long-term source of funding, we can do all the balancing we want, but the system's going down. And we should be going forward because we ought to be out there. Our planning in V-Trans 2035 is futuristic. We have talents within the department and consultant-wise to be futuristic. We have an exciting opportunities in transit and public transportation, and we're missing all of those.
Any other questions? Mr. Sterling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Raiden, you may not have this with you. If you don't, you can get it to us. Sort of what Ms. Panic talked about in terms of there's lots of zeros in there at the end, and there are a lot of projects, and we kind of hope the revenues will come in the next year and we'll be able to start moving forward on those projects. But we do have a number of projects partially funded. Do we know what that total deficit, how much for this program right here, if we were to fully fund it over the 6-year period, what do we need?
You're looking for the cost to complete report.
Cost to complete that is not programmed.
Correct.
And basically, whatever the required after 2016 total is.
That's something that takes a while to prepare, but we are going to do that starting next month. We'll start developing that report and get that out to everybody.
And how realistic? Because I did some of these projects in here. I know that the total estimated cost is way overinflated. So is it going to be a refined and a real good, tight cost to complete, or is this going to be one of those, if everything goes terrible and costs are twice what we expect them to realistically be, it'll be?
What we would be using is the schedules and estimates that are in project development pool as they are. Now, we can do some, get with the districts and get some fine-tuning of the projects, but for this number of projects to get something in a timely fashion to look at, we can only touch each project so much. So we would be looking at the data already in the system in terms of estimates and schedules and allocations to date.
Well, maybe that's where we need to start. But
I think it would be a good start.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. King.
Would that report also include the maintenance needs, unfunded maintenance needs, as part of that project? Because he's talking about construction.
It would be what's in the 6-year program. There are some dual-funded projects, and there are some maintenance projects in the program, but it wouldn't pick up everything in terms of asset investment maintenance that Connie is doing.
We could add it. It would show the number that we need to bring pavement into compliance. And
we could do that. Sure. Yes, we could make that a complete picture.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would just add, I think it's very healthy to know what it would cost to do what we've already committed to do and what we have to do to maintain the multi-billion-dollar investment we already have, so that those who appropriate the money have a fair sense of what we're talking about. And I know the number that's occasionally bandied about from the V-Trans 2025 report is cited, but that's not a hard number. What we're talking about is getting a hard number, and it'd probably be something less than the 2025 estimate, but I somehow think if we could get it to people that we really do have, whatever the number is, $60 billion, $70 billion, $80 billion, in real needs that we already know about and that it will cost us over the next decade to do, and we have, you know, $5, $10, $20 billion in revenues, there's a gap that somehow is a real gap. And there are consequences. So I guess I would like to see it compared to what alternative scenario included, saying, you know, if we proceed along where we are right now with the projected revenues we have, the consequences start falling out this way. The number of miles that continue to deteriorate, the number of bridges that can't be replaced or repaired, et cetera, et cetera, the number of rail opportunities that are foregone, that will never complete the high-speed rail line if we don't have some money for it, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of things that people say they want us to do and fund, and I guess I wish they would also say just as passionately how much they are willing to pony up to do that, because they're really, if we can give them real numbers, however it's financed, we might have a better shot of getting it financed if we know what it is we're really shooting for.
Yes. One more comment. Mr. McCarthy's comment, I've been on this board a year, and speaking the other night, I talked to Ms. Panic about this in a conversation the other night, and someone asked me, well, what have you found out in the year that you've been involved? And what first came to mind was the short of revenues, and also it was much worse than I thought. But what really came to mind is that we've accepted this situation, that somehow the state says it's okay. So what can this board do to say it's not okay? I think that's what I think we're trying to say. It's just not okay. And maybe it's a billboard we can put up there like the national debt instead of per unit.
We don't have any money for that.
I understand that. But my point is, that's where I think the frustration I am, is that it's just not okay. But that doesn't seem to be, and as a board member, I guess I'm asking, what can I do other than vote no? Which, as Mr. Coulombe says, is not a viable option, really. So, anyway, that's where I'm at with Mr. McCarthy.
But the one thing we all got to keep in mind is, okay, we'll know what the number is for this commitment, but then we may need to take a real hard look at those commitments may not be there. It's
absolutely
not just,
that's right.
We're going to have to take a careful look. It's not just, well, maybe there's going to be additional revenues. We're going to have a new way of thinking in terms of additional public-private partnerships, whether it's toll roads, things of that nature. We're going to have to make some hard decisions based on revenues available, requirements.
Absolutely.
After we do a scrub and look at that, what the requirements are, what the revenues are, and how do we propose going forward in any way, including reduction of projects or looking at these other, what would be different ways of doing things.
I totally agree.
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, the Honorable Walter Stosch, who's been in the Virginia Senate for a very long time and is quite an expert on these matters, once addressed an audience here in Richmond, and he said, actually, you know, what the General Assembly is good at are annual things that are fairly simple and straightforward. What we're really bad at are things that are multi-year, complex, that require commitments over time. He said it's kind of a function of the legislature, but it's also a function of a part-time legislature. And how to get that attention, I think, is what we're all trying to deal with. But also, I'm trying to emphasize the board's responsibilities, regardless of the responsibilities of other people in this system. We have responsibilities to be honest and to understand what's actually happening. Mr. McCarthy began to hint at that. The fact is, through default, we are making tremendous policy changes in the historic way the Commonwealth works in its transportation sector. For example, we heard a presentation last fall about the idea of a core network of road miles. It was about less than half of the system. It sparked a conversation here. You can't just abandon half the system. You can't just not maintain roads that people need. Well, actually, that's exactly what we're doing.
That's right.
If you look at what Ms. Sorrell is about to present to us, we're actually choosing a core network of roads to maintain in Virginia. We're just not saying that we're doing that. We're doing it backwards through the budgeting process instead of policy. On the transit side, at a time when even small communities are anxious to expand their transit operations, we're saying basically we're giving disincentives to that happening. at a time when we need localities to be building their capacity to manage projects and understand land use and transportation connections, we're cutting the very program that encourages them to do that. So we're actually making all these decisions, but we're just not consciously making them. We're just making them through the budget. I think if you added those things up and we all could come up with a list of about four or five that are important in our districts as well as the ones to the state, you would have something that actually nobody in the assembly would endorse. Nobody in government would actually put out as their program. And yet that's kind of what's happening. This is a very difficult time because what we've realized is the short-term decisions we've made in the budget over the last couple of years have really come home to roost now. These needs come up. They accumulate annually. And if we dealt with them in a better way annually, they wouldn't build. But they're just, this is the magic of compounding now. The neglect that we've put into the system over the last decade, let's say, is now we don't have the resources to even do what we say are our priorities. And we've covered that up. We've tried not to talk about it directly, but I think at Thomas' comment, we have to do that. And maybe that's what we have to do as a board. Maybe we need to compile that list of policy decisions that we've made. We're required to work things through a formula. We just stopped doing that. That wasn't legislative action, as you said. It was something that we just sort of backed into. I think this is more serious than the budget now. And I think we need to find a way to deal with it more seriously.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just be brief on this, and it's a half thought, but I've heard my colleagues speak all quite eloquently over time, over the year I've been here, of the problems. And it seems to me, and I don't know how this works, but it seems to me that the CTB could put together, maybe based on what Mr. Coulombe has suggested, a resolution or a summary letter to the General Assembly saying, we've approved a budget if we're going to do that, and I think there's serious problems if we don't approve a budget. We could do line item, I suppose, and go through approve, certain aspects and say, well, we'll put the next ones off to October or to January or February. But it may be that it's worthwhile for us to write a letter as a board that we have a consensus on that says we are concerned about these following items. And then that way we can send that message. Because I don't know, the legislature doesn't have an opportunity to hear us go through these discussions. It's very hard to figure out how the decision-making is being made if you're from the outside. And I think it would be productive to do some summaries on that and to talk about those things that we see are not being funded that we think are serious. And, it's the view of 17 people, but we're supposed to be the ones that most know this after the staff.
Instead of a letter, why don't we do a resolution?
I like that, sir.
Okay. So we can have one drafted up. Ms. Busher, I'm just sort of intrigued by something. So this year we'll transfer $500 million from the construction account to the maintenance account, right?
Yes, sir.
If we were to use that for debt service, how much would that buy us? Given where today's given our bond rating and the rates we're getting today, how much in bonds would that have gotten us?
When we looked at the bang for the buck, so to speak, from the last issue with the impact of the Build America bonds, we were getting about $14 million per.
14?
We could borrow 14 for $1 million in debt.
So for $500 million worth of
debt service
would be about $7 billion. How much? $7 billion for the capital.
Now it would be less than that, probably without the Build America bonds.
Okay.
John, is it more like 10 or 12 million?
Between $5 to $7 billion in new capital, if we weren't transferring that amount, right? So when we look at some of the issues we're facing, it is in many ways, maybe a lot of the focus needs to be on operations and maintenance and what's happening and how that's being funded. Because we are putting money, quite a bit of money, into the TTF that is being transferred over to the HMOF.
Yes. So if what you are proposing is selling bonds for the
construction. When we look out in the long term, I mean, we have to maybe start to it as a basic issue.
Absolutely.
I mean, where the statutorily, it sets the priorities for us, for all our funds, maybe we should end up looking at the two funds separately and funding maintenance differently than we do fund construction. When you look at some of these things, we start to peel some of this back. I mean, obviously there's a concern that we are being told that our needs, our maintenance needs, are higher than the money we're putting in. So therefore, we did make a value judgment, or are going to be making a value judgment,
yes,
that the maintenance levels that we're going to go with are actually less than if they were the optimum numbers.
We did.
We actually met the legal responsibility.
Right.
Part of that, because without issuing bonds, so to speak, the cash flow was federal, and only so much of that could go to maintenance.
And it goes back to our whole program now,
right,
is revolving around the federal matches,
right,
and the federal priorities. And the fact that we're making judgments not based on needs, but based on
the
source of the funding.
Yes, sir.
And that is one of the conundrums. It is a revenue issue overall, but it is also the source of those revenues and the strings that come attached to those. And so we just don't. It's broader than just simply looking at the amount of money. It's when we get that money, is it making us make bad decisions? Or I'm going to say maybe not the best decision, not bad decision, not the best decision.
For the whole system, right.
Because in Dr. Davis's, you know, let's say in his area, I mean, the best decision is to put where your secondary roads are the quote-unquote primary roads in other parts of rural Virginia, where we, because we're chasing federal dollars, are putting it all into.
And those roads don't allow the use of federal dollars in some cases.
Yeah, so we just turn our back to it. Shorts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think there's another side to this issue, too. In conversations that I have had over the last 4 years with members of the General Assembly, both parties, there has been a consistent thread of the following. We understand that transportation needs more money in Virginia. We don't have any confidence that the process of prioritization and the process of allocation would get that money if we funded it to the right projects. And as I say, that is an observation, a conclusion that I have heard from members of the General Assembly, both houses, both parties. I think there is an element of starving the beast going on in the General Assembly and has been for some time, not because nobody wants to spend any money or make any investments, but because in a resource-constrained economy, there just isn't the level of confidence that the right projects are going to be funded. In other words, that this 4-inch book isn't the right book. I know that all of us over the past several years, as we look through this book, find some projects that we think are absolutely sensible and others that we think aren't. I will say that there has been a winnowing out of some of the less sensible ones over the years, but probably more baby steps than big steps. I think that rather than this board sending a resolution to the General Assembly, you know, expressing frustration with the lack of funding, maybe we're better off going to the bipartisan leadership of the General Assembly and saying, what has to happen in transportation in Virginia
to give the Transportation Secretariat and VDOT the credibility to earn your confidence back and initiate that dialogue. I think that's where we need to head. This is a relatively new administration, and I think comes in with an opportunity to really initiate that dialogue and potentially through that get the funding back on track. I think that that's at least part of what's at the root of the problem here. Thank you.
So is that how your city, your town council works?
My town council doesn't work.
Okay, enough said. All right, well, let's first start on a resolution, because I think it'll be interesting to see as we work on the verbiage of it, whether we all agree on what the issues are. And then let's build on that foundation. Okay?
Right.
Now we're all up and ready and primed for you, Mr. L.
The good news for lunch.
Yeah, I just feel like I've been kind of like it feels like sometimes attending your own funeral here. All the bad news that I've that's been talked about that I'm going to deliver here. Oops. Uh oh. So as I was listening to some of Rita's presentation while I'm pulling this up, it sort of reminded me of a comment when I was from Motorola University. Motorola is one of those organizations that has so many acronyms that they have acronyms for their acronyms, and I sort of feel like VDOT is that way. We have TLAs and FLAs. TLAs are three-letter acronyms, and FLAs are four-letter acronyms. So I hope that I have weeded out most of the acronyms, and I'm just... Is this? I hope that this is it. Okay. Well, all right. Okay. So hopefully I can make the bad news less painful by going through it a little bit more quickly and sort of getting to the punchline here. To reiterate what the Secretary was talking about, this is a slide that's from some of Rita's earlier slides that talks about the revenues is the top side of the chart, and it shows where all the different sources of our income are, how much we get in the way of revenue from those various sources. And this particular chart shows that the construction program has $511 million in it that's being transferred to the HMO. Then the next table here shows where the HFMO, the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, is actually funding several things, including a small amount in our environmental program. It funds the payments to city streets of about $352 million. That also includes the maintenance payments for Arlington and RICO that by statute come off the top. And also, the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund also funds the administrative overhead of the department, and that's about $212 million. As Rita said, we have been squeezing that down to try and economize as best we can in our overhead. So out of that $1.8 billion that is in the HMOF, the part that comes to the maintenance and operations program is just a little under $1.2 billion. And then if you take the yellow line and you read across, you'll see that there is $155 million of federal funds that provides the $1.3 billion that we have to work with. So very quickly, I'm going to go through these slides. We laid out that the Code of Virginia has several requirements. It does define what maintenance is, and it does tell us several reports we need to do. And the very first section up here is the one that requires us to do a biennial needs assessment in odd numbered years. So last September, for those of you who were at the September board meeting, I went through in much more detail than I'm going to do today the needs assessment and what the methodology is, and you know how we go about using various pavement management systems, bridge management systems that we have, what kinds of inventories we have of our assets, and how we calculate those needs. And the code does require us to use what's called an asset management system, which is a way of looking at life cycle cost of assets and how to get the best, longest use out of them and when they do need to be replaced, budgeting for those things. So to skip on, we have really two overarching program goals in maintenance and operations, and the very first one is to be an emergency response organization. And I know most people don't really think about VDOT when they think about emergency response because they think about the fire and police. But actually, we're out there. It's actually our road. As the owner of the road, we're responsible for most of what goes on there. And so we have a critical role in snow removal and all the various storms and making sure that travelers are safe out on the road. So we do consider ourselves a very important partner in the emergency management of the state. So so this really is sort of the bread and butter of the maintenance organization, where we make sure that we have the resources we need to fight snow and floods and all the other related emergencies we have. We have our incident management programs there. This part of the services budget, it pays for operating all of our facilities. We have 5 traffic operations centers. We have half a dozen mountain and river tunnels. We've got over a dozen movable bridges, 43 rest areas, seven ferries, and over 50 parking lots that we maintain for commuter purposes. And then we also have some funds that we use to just make sure that our troops have enough materials to patch potholes, replace pipes, keep them clean, those kinds of things. So this really is what we call really the housekeeping budget. This is what keeps the lights on at the office and keeps the lights burning for the traffic signals and those kinds of things. The next category is what we call the asset category of maintenance and operations, and this is where we really are using money to repair, rehabilitate, restore the life cycle of various pavements and bridges, performing replacements based on life cycle for traffic signal components, for example, variable message boards, cameras that we use for emergency purposes on the roads, and those types of things. So you all have heard quite a bit, I think, over the years about the performance measures we have, that no more than 18% of interstate and primary pavements would be rated deficient. This is a structural deficiency rating so that we have good structural pavements. It's not just a seat-of-your-pants rideability rating. We have been having the same target for bridges, that no more than 8% of bridges would be deficient in any one year. Based on our latest data, which for pavements was at the end of 2008 for that paving season, we had 20% on the interstate deficient, 24% on the primary deficient, and even though we don't have a target for secondary pavements, about 31% of the secondary pavements statewide are deficient. And as one of the members noted, in Northern Virginia, those pavements are much more severe due to the heavy amount of traffic that they have. We did slip slightly in the percentage of bridges that are structurally deficient. This is a very high-level slide that shows you the baseline of the needs assessment from back in 2009. It was updated for some bridge numbers that needed to be updated financially. So it's $1.9 billion for each of the 2 years in this biennium. So as you can see, the big gorilla in the room is pavement. If we were to fix all the interstate pavements and primary pavements so that no more than 18% would be deficient, and if we set a target to keep the secondary system from getting any worse than the 31% that it is, that would be require an investment of $709 million this year and $711 million next year. So you can see out of the $1.9 billion of needs that $700 million of that is just in pavement rehabilitation and pavement repair and restoration and also preventative maintenance. In this pavement analysis, I want to point out one thing, and that is all of the pavement needs, for the most part, are being shown here in the maintenance budget. We really don't say that as a policy that at some point when a maintenance when a pavement needs to be rebuilt, that there is an ongoing program in the six-year plan that pays for a portion of rebuilding the major systems each year. Unlike in the bridge program, these bridge numbers are basically just to do the preventative types of maintenance and sort of ongoing maintenance. This number does not include what it would cost to replace all the deficient bridges or to keep deficient bridges at less than 8% because those needs are met in the six-year plan. I'm sure if you look through your six-year plan, you'll see there are tremendous numbers of bridges being replaced in the six-year plan. And a lot of that is because we've had the federal dollars available in the six-year plan. The federal government has really had a priority on bridges and making sure they don't fall down. And so we've recognized that there's a point at which a bridge goes from being in the maintenance program to being in the construction program. But we don't have that same sort of recognition on the pavement side of the house. So that's something that Rita and the commissioner and I have been working on. So in the 2016 plan you have in front of you, we have proposed a change so that we will start on the interstate and primary having funds available to do this kind of major reconstruction work, which would take that portion of the needs basically out of the maintenance needs assessment. So that we wouldn't continue to say these are, quote, maintenance needs, because they really are new construction or reconstruction needs. So the other thing I would point out is even though some of the other numbers are relatively small in comparison to pavement, we do have tremendous needs in traffic and safety, which includes things like pavement markings and rumble strips and guardrail and 3,500 signals that we maintain across the Commonwealth and any numbers of other technology, software replacements and things like that that are necessary in order to keep our system running. So we...
Yes.
Mr. Real, do you think it would be something that we should do in terms of establishing a target for the percentage of deficiency on the secondary roads? Because as this report comes forward next year, instead of accepting the 31 or 32%, it may be 33%, and it's kind of a growing number of deficient secondary roads, and we just simply accept that without having a target here.
Well, I think that is something for the board to consider as we move forward. I certainly am going to start reporting it, and if the board wishes us to establish a target, even though we may not be able to meet it, then we certainly would do that,
yeah,
I would
correct.
Presume, looking to my commissioner there to give me some guidance. Let me just go to the next slide, which is now the difference between what we've said the needs are back in September and what the budget is available to meet these needs. It's $1.345 billion, so we are about... We have a gap of about $600 million, and over $450 million of that is in pavement. So that really is the big gap. So if we could find some way to try and relook at how we are funding some of the pavement needs we have, that would certainly go a long way toward helping meet the needs. Now, we do think on the interstate pavements that as we've put about 90% of the money that's needed there, and we think with some of the other money that was put in earlier with some of the ARRA projects that we are going to be able to probably meet the 18% on the interstate. This budget proposal would put about 60% in what is needed for pavement for the primary system. So we certainly don't expect to be able to meet the 18%, but we do think we can move from where we are today at about 24% up to about 22%. So we can try and knock off some of that deficiency in the pavement in the primary. And, of course, most of our traffic is on the interstate and primary systems. However, in the secondary system, we only have about 20% left out of that allocation here to really look at secondary pavements. And so we will probably continue to see a decline of about 3 to 4% in the secondary system over the next year based on these figures. As you can see, we still have only slightly funded traffic and safety and traffic operations and technology at about half, a little more than half, in what we need. I also want to note that in the services side of the budget, we have squeezed that number down to mostly hold our field organization at their 2010 budget level. So we are really trying to use every economy we can possibly use to be as an efficient organization as we can there, still increase the rest areas. We have funded the rest areas. And we have put about $15 million more in snow removal emergency operations than we had. But this is only, it's about a $25 million increase over last year's services budget. 15 of that went into the emergency services. The other 10 went into some of the rest areas and some reserves that we feel like we need to have. But very, very little change other than that. So once again, we're really trying to keep our belt tight by not having any increases in that operations area so we can put as much of the increase that we were getting into the asset side of the house. The next several slides are just some slides about conditions. I think all of you all have seen these from previous times, so I'm not going to go through them again, but just to show you, we've got a wave of bridges that are in not very good condition, marching down toward being in deficient condition. This is a distribution of pavements. And so where we have pavements that are in really bad condition, those are the ones that we're really talking about needing reconstruction, and that's a much more expensive proposition. This is the history of...
Back on the bridge issue, one of the things I've always found with bridge, when we talk deficient, everybody automatically assumes it's going to collapse. And there's two types of deficient. It's structurally, which is, yeah, that's a problem, yes. And then there's the capacity.
Well, there's obsolete. I don't have this. I can't break them down from this particular slide. I can certainly get them to you, but we have functionally obsolete. You know, functionally deficient. The deficiency is really that there's a danger that it's able to carry less load, structurally deficient, as opposed to just being obsolete, that it doesn't have shoulders or it has
sidewalks.
Yeah, so we're not talking about obsolescence here. We're talking about deficiencies. So when you get a bridge that's a four or less, these are structurally deficient that need to be replaced. And even some of them that are in category five are structurally deficient to the point that they need to be for a particular element of the bridge. This is the overall bridge rating. It may be a five, but there might be some subcomponents that make it also structurally deficient to the point that it needs to be replaced. And I'm sure the man wearing the bridge tie in the back here could answer more questions about that later. Yeah. Okay, so if we were to fix all the pavements in the world and make everything a perfect world, it would be $2.8 billion, but we're not talking about that. We set our target. It's $708 million. So one of the things that you will see sometimes is, one of the most difficult things that we have to do in the field is deciding which ones of these pavements are going to get fixed because we can't fix them all. And sometimes those judgments are very difficult because the needs are great. This gives you a look.
I can help with that.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you. The next slide just shows you how much of it is broken down. So preventive maintenance is only $25 million of the needs, but it only costs $8,000 a lane mile to do preventive maintenance. So you can do a lot of preventive maintenance for $25 million. That's thousands of miles. On the other hand, that $1,800 million for reconstruction costs are anywhere from $500,000 a mile up to over $1 million a mile, depending on how basically rotten the subbase is and how much you have to do to reconstruct that road back to structural sufficiency.
Preventive and reconstruction.
8,000 a lane mile to more than $500,000 to $1 million a lane mile. So that's how, you can see the restoration. Sometimes there's really not a lot of difference between, there's a fine difference between what's in restoration and what really ought to be over in construction. So some of that probably ought to be in the reconstruction program as well. So if we were to do all that $700 million worth of work, you can see we would be working on about 14% of the interstate, 14% of the primary miles and about 12% of the secondary miles. We have about 105,000 lane miles of paved roads in the state, so that can kind of give you an idea about how many there are. There are about 5,600 on the interstate, about 17,000 on the primary, and the rest of those would be paved secondary roads. So very quickly to tell you about the budget process, we take these needs based on the systems that we have to evaluate our conditions, and we propose the distribution based on this. We can break those needs down to show each district what percentage of their needs there are in pavement. So it may be that Richmond District has 15% of the pavement needs and Salem has 18% of the pavement needs, so we can say what that is based on the condition of their pavements. And so we propose that level of funding. We work with the field and come up with various scenarios about how to make the money fit the needs we have. And so we went through about 8 or 9 scenarios. The one that is recommended here does propose a distribution across the investments and services, and it's the one that you saw in the chart earlier. And once we provided that, we've reviewed it at the executive level. The districts actually build their detailed budgets, and we do a final review to make sure that there's not a wide gap in between what we've recommended for them and how they actually have proposed to spend that budget. Sometimes there are some emergency situations or some local conditions that we don't always know about, and we work through those differences to have a common understanding of what their budgets are for the districts moving forward. So this is the same chart you saw earlier with the needs versus the budget on it. And what this does is it takes those needs and it breaks it down so that each district gets its proportionate share of the needs in these areas. And so we can actually say what those needs are in pavements, in bridges, in technology, those sorts of things, in terms of giving them guidance in how to build their budgets.
Mr. Chairman, when you say that 31% of the secondary roads are deficient pavements, mm-hmm. is that a preventive maintenance solution or is it a reconstruction solution?
It's all of the above.
All of the above. I guess I'd like to get a sense of, as long as we're talking about all this ways to use money efficiently and effectively, how to allocate the budget, because budget is policy. That's the first thing they teach you in public administration school.
That's
despite
right.
all the other stuff, budget is policy. And if we have the opportunity to spend $8,000 a lane mile versus $500,000 a lane mile, I mean, duh. I mean, how stupid do we have to be to choose the big number instead of the small number?
Well, I've put this slide back on the board to show you that the $700 million worth of needs, based on what the pavement recommendations are, would be that there ought to be, and I can go back to the next slide, we ought to do preventive maintenance on 2,300 lane miles. But we don't have $700 million. We only have about $300 million. So we have to figure out, you know, what's the best use of that money to keep some section of interstate from completely falling apart. It may need to be reconstructed. We don't have the money to reconstruct it, so we might go out and put a 3 or 4 inch overlay on it just to keep it together for another 4 or 5 years until maybe we could get it into the 6-year plan or find some ARRA money for it or some other treatment. So, you know, this is a difficult set of choices that are being made every day. But we do know what are the recommended treatments, which roads need to have preventive maintenance versus which roads need to have other treatments.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Real, on slide 17, again,
yes.
Follow up with the secondary pavement needs number versus the budget number. Do I understand you correctly that 338.3 represents the needs to maintain the 31%?
Correct.
Rate?
Correct.
So if we only spend 60.7, then that's going to really increase over this next.
Well, the payment model is suggesting that it'll decrease by about 4%, 3 to 4% in this 1 year.
Last 3 years, it's been about that much.
Right.
Yeah.
This represents 37,000 miles of our
57,000 miles pavement in the state.
Well, the secondary road system, the $700 million would work on almost 10,000 lane miles of road in the secondary system. We're not going to be able to work on 10,000 lane miles of highways.
The rest continue to deteriorate.
Yeah.
So we really need to look at this number as a reconstruction number, because we're never going to be catch up with that if we don't have an infusion of maintenance on these secondary.
Well, you know, really, when you think about it, the secondary construction program is largely a major paving reconstruction program. What counties have done over the last many years, and so, you know, now that program has dwindled to the point that there's no state money going into the urban construction program or the secondary construction program, and even the six-year plan, there's really not that much new construction that allows for reconstruction of existing lanes, where the maintenance program used to get a good arm lift up from the construction program. That's not there anymore. So the needs for in the maintenance area, particularly in pavements, is being exacerbated by the lack of funding that's available in the construction program. And as Rita was talking about earlier, that, you know, there's no way to meet all these needs by taking state dollars out of the construction program to put here to use on these secondary roads, because they mostly don't qualify for federal funds, and we would lose those federal funds if we pull, and you wouldn't want to use bond money to do maintenance. So therein lies the conundrum. So I just want to show you this is how it's split by each of the districts, and largely the differences are because of the pavement needs. Since the pavement is such a big portion of what the needs are, that's what's driving it. But the only thing I want to point out here in slide 18 is that we're back to funding maintenance at the same level we were funding it in 2009. So the 4% increase that we got was based on a reduced budget, a reduced program when it was cut back last year. So. And the reductions that we've had with the program. So the next slide, 2019, I do want to point out that $352 million that I showed you in the very front slide for city street maintenance payments, if I show you that by district, you now have the whole $1.7 billion maintenance program for state and local governments. And I would just point out in Hampton Roads, one of the reasons why Hampton Roads is very healthy with respect to this particular slide as opposed to the previous one, is that there are many independent cities in Hampton Roads, and so they benefit by having those city street maintenance payments. So last but not least, as required by the Code of Virginia, the commissioner is to report to the board what we expect in the way of outcomes for the coming fiscal year, and so this slide is a summary of that we do expect to make sure that we are able to deliver emergency response, incident management, keep our facilities open, and respond to citizen calls and requests for services. And we also are anticipating on meeting the interstate pavement performance target of 18%, but we expect only to meet about 22% for primaries, and we do anticipate that secondary payments are going to continue to decline, probably around 4%. I'll have a report for the end of the 2009 paving season that will be available in September for you. We've been collecting that data, and it's not quite all in yet, and we're working on that, and we'll have that, and that's a required report as well in September. And so for bridges, we are anticipating about 8.5% of bridges will be structurally deficient. And just as an aside, for all the bridges that we did fix in the construction program, about that many more plus about another 40 or so became deficient over the last year. So even though we've been having a very aggressive program in bridge replacement in the six-year plan, we've got a wave of old bridges that we still, you know, haven't quite completely funded to be able to keep it at that 8%.
Deficient by inspection or deficient by a formula? We figure they're deficient because
they're deficient based on this the inspection process that we do that says that they're structurally deficient.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions?
And I think, Mr. Lane, you didn't want these presentations.
So well, I want them. We already had them, but that's good.
I have a question. Mr. Goulamay.
On slide four, you gave us the statutory requirement for your report by September 15th. If I remember correctly, when you gave us that briefing in September, you said something like, we cannot maintain system assets at the current level of funding.
That's correct.
Did you get any reaction to that report when it was sent to the General Assembly?
I have not received a single letter or phone call.
I get it.
Okay.
I don't get, I mean, Mr. Chairman, I don't get that.
I will also share with you, I thought that was very interesting. It just so happened, I don't remember what was going on that day, but there weren't any members of the press available, so there was never even any press coverage of the report either, so it was interesting.
All I would say is this, Mr. Chairman. I think this, more than anything else, really makes the case of what we were talking about before. Despite the legal requirements, the statutory requirements, despite the, you know, the audits that are suggested by the General Assembly, and despite all that attention we get, the fact is we aren't fulfilling our responsibilities as required under the law. And it's interesting when you pass laws or set standards or whatever and then ignore them. You know, it invites the public to have exactly the cynical attitude about this that Mr. Schwartz hinted at earlier. In fact, it invites it from this board that, you know, let me know when you're going to get serious and we'll get serious. I don't know how to break this cycle of low expectations and, oh, shoot, we have performance standards, we just don't meet them. Or, as Mr. Keene pointed out, well, we don't really want to have performance standards because we're not actually going to meet them, so let's not have standards in the first place. This turns into a very cyclical cynicism that undermines, you know, our whole system of government. And I'm very worried about this. And we've made the short-term adjustments, you know, month to month over the last two and a half years. But I think we've sort of hit, I feel like we hit rock bottom here. We have no capacity to address the things we are required to do, and we have no intention of doing it. I mean, here's the plan to do basically two-thirds of what we're legally required to do. I don't know about you, but our business doesn't run that way. I don't run my own life that way. It's very upsetting to me at the moment.
On that depressing note, why don't we take a 10-minute break and grab lunches, and we'll start back up at 1 o'clock. Can we ask everyone to please take their seats? The next presentation is the six-year plan from our friends at the RPT. Steve Pritter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As I said earlier, I'm going to try to be brief and get through this because we have briefed all the members of the board in the same presentation in the last few days. That being said, six-year program update, it's a few of the slides that we went through in May. I am going to pick out a few highlights here on the overall program. Really want to focus on the operating side of both rail and transit. For transit, we did exercise in the current year a couple of administrative options to keep the funding level the same as it was in our December program. And in addition to in doing that, we still, the eligible share still declined. We're at a 15%, slightly under 15% of total costs, and at 36% of eligible costs. And I guess I always point out to y'all, before the past 2 years, the recordation tax, we thought we were going to actually be going the other direction. And there's a chart you'll see where actually our share has declined once again. And The other bullet, sub-bullet there is we have the Dulles Metro Rail project coming online in 2013 and the Norfolk Light Rail project coming on in service in May of 11. And both of those projects aren't adding revenues to our stream. They're actually adding expenditures to the base that our revenues are spread over. So we'll make that percentage decline even more. And on the rail side, the main item I'll point out here is we're starting up passenger rail service across the state. We have the Lynchburg service, we have Norfolk service we're planning in 3 years, and we have a Richmond train that's going to begin in July of this year. So we started state-sponsored passenger rail service, intercity passenger rail service. But when we started that, it was set up as a demonstration project. And a big portion of that, there were two reasons for that. One, to see how successful the service was. But then number two, we don't have a dedicated stream to fund the subsidy requirements for intercity passenger rail. And you'll notice in the six-year plan, if you've looked in detail at the rail section, there's a $41 million unfunded amount for the subsidy at the end of the six-year period for these trains that we're beginning. And that's further complicated under the federal legislation that the regional trains in Virginia also, if that legislation is not removed or overturned or delayed, we would have to pick up the subsidy for those trains. I believe that's four trains in addition to the three that we're starting. So that's a big issue for us, and so is the transit operations amount of funding that we're providing. The next slide, once again, is just a three-year comparison. No difference than when we were here in May. Slight change from last year's revised program, and mainly that's just adding a sixth year of the State of Good Repair funding for WMATA. So last year we had $250 million because that funding began FY11. This year it's actually six full years, so there's $300 million. This is the chart I spoke on that shows the decline in the operating funding match that the state provides. And once again, we had hoped in 2009 with recordation tax dedication to this transit operations that we'd actually see those two ribbons going the other direction. Rather, what's happened with the decline in revenues is both TTF and recordation, as we've seen the opposite trend, and that's compounded by our services, the growth in our services, the growth in ridership during that time, so which costs more funds. So the revenues decline and the base expenditures are increasing. These are the basic assumptions we went through last time. I spoke on that we did do some administrative items to make the operating funding equal. We did this year choose to fund rolling stock replacement at 80%, and all other capital applications that were approved were blended bond funding and mass transit trust fund funding to come to a 53% for all other assets. And that's, you know, we're trying to move to a trend where we can provide our providers a stable level of match for certain classifications of assets. So that they can, you know, I personally and as an agency, we've been pushing on them to do better long-term capital budgeting. And part of that is knowing, you know, what share the state can bring to the table. So we're internally trying to do what we can within the existing structure of code and Appropriation Act language to be able to start providing that structure to our providers that when you come to us for a replacement vehicle, you can expect 80% funding. The other item here is we did the overall blended match did drop to 53% for capital, and that's mostly due to last year we had $30 million of ARRA funds that covered 100% of quite a few of our capital applications. Also, the amount of bond funding available in the current year, the capacity is slightly less than last year. And finally, we do have from the Mass Transit Trust Fund and at the Rail Fund, you'll see on the next slide, the Rail Preservation Rail Enhancement Fund, a 2.5% proposed allocation to cover our agency costs, not just our overhead or administrative costs, but our actual project management costs. On the rail side, we we did not get the $1.7 billion we applied for in stimulus funds. So we have had to take a look at the rail resource allocation plan and make some deviation from that plan because of the lack of funding. I spoke on the lack of operating funds. We have been given some Appropriation Act language to use some rail enhancement funds to cover the current year subsidy requirement. So we need to complete Senate Joint Resolution Number 63 has asked us to study this issue. We need to complete that issue, and hopefully maybe the topic can be addressed in the coming General Assembly session. One of my concerns is, you know, we started the Lynchburg train. We're 8 months into that service, and the results of that are very good. So good, in fact, that I'm worried that we get to November, we'll take those results and project them that that's how all passenger intercity passenger rail service works, and therefore there won't be a need for any subsidy, so this isn't even an issue. So one thing to keep in mind is, you know, we said before to y'all, Kevin did a great job negotiating with Amtrak, and we got a basically we get 79% of the revenue. If you get on Lynchburg, you go to Maine, we get 79% of that whole ticket comes to us, despite the fact that the majority of the mileage under that trip is up in the northeast quarter, not even in Virginia. So we suspect in year two Amtrak's going to take a close look at that, and maybe I'm doubting Kevin's abilities to negotiate a little bit, but anyway, I just have that concern that people will take those results and project them to a completely different situation in Norfolk and Richmond. The next item, the General Assembly did waive the 30% match requirement for funding, for capital funding on the proposed Norfolk passenger, intercity passenger train from Norfolk through to Richmond. Additionally, as I said before, we did take the 2.5% we're proposing that the board allow us to take 2.5% of the current year Rail Enhancement Fund and Rail Preservation Fund to help us manage our projects. And the last slide on the six-year program is basically just a summary of changes that were made since May. I think I sent out a detailed list. Hopefully all of y'all got that, and we talked about it. For the most part, there was some redistribution of federal funding due to an error in the way some of our small urban providers applied to us. Nobody lost funding. It was just a shift of the type of federal funding that was provided to those grantees. And a few grantees, we had allocated some federal dollars to, and they didn't want the strings that were attached to those federal dollars, so they accepted a lowered amount of funding. And a few grantees looked at their applications and decided they weren't ready to go at this point, so they pulled them. Metro Matters, they had some funds left over from 2010. We allowed them to carry those forward to 2011, which ended up reducing the amount that we had programmed in May to where we are today. Potomac Yard Crystal City Project, Alexandria, wasn't able to come up with their local match for the project. It was a sort of a joint project with Arlington, and Alexandria wasn't able to come up with their local share. We had already reviewed the project, thought it was a good project, and we did have some available flexible STP funds that we were able to substitute so the project could proceed. And then other than that, there's just basically minor technical corrections. Maybe the footing error, perhaps, where, you know, rounding was involved. With that, I just want to take you quickly through our budget document. Y'all should have all received that, to this document. In the first two slides, I just want to focus on briefly the difference between this and the six-year program for us. Six-year program takes our revenues that we get and allocates that out to projects. So it's not necessarily when the actual cash is going to go out the door. This document is actually taking all the projects that we have
from the current year, a six-year program, and prior year's projects that aren't complete, and what are we actually going to spend on those projects and also our internal operations in the current year. So there's the third bullet here shows the main reason for differences. One of those being federal funds that you as the board have the discretion to allocate. Then the transit providers receive those funds directly, so they don't go through my financial records. There's also, as I've said before, a development lag on the transit capital side that, you know, you're buying buses. You don't go out and buy them off the lot. It takes a while. And then finally, the General Assembly in the past has come through and given us sizable general fund earmarks. And when we get an earmark of $40 million for a rolling stock acquisition with WMATA, for example, that happened in 2005, and it took almost 3 or 4 years for ultimately that to actually be worked through for the actual expenditure of those funds. The next slide, I'm not going to go in much detail because it does provide the detail to reconcile for 11 this document to our six-year program. So if you look at the first page of our six-year program, you'll see a total of $341 million. And this has a total of $165 million, and this actually gives you the detail of those differences. Next slide gives some highlights of some of the major items that are we do expect to have expenditures in our current year budget. And y'all can read through that. The next slide is a pie chart of our budget broken down by a service area as the way the General Assembly allocates our funds. Total of $465 million for the year. Public transportation is about 60% of that total. Then we have rail programs. It's a little slightly under or slightly above 20%. And then we have the Dulles Corridor Metro Rail program. Those are the three dominant slices of that pie. And we do anticipate that that remaining funding for the Dulles Corridor Metro Rail project will go out the door in 11. So that piece of that pie will shrink down to real small size with the other. So it basically will be to rail and public transportation dominating this next year. In the public transportation side, we show an increase. If you look at the back of this, we have a comparison last year's budget to this year, and there's a slight increase there of $30 million. And that's really the $50 million state of good repair. And then also we allocated funds to ARRA last year, but we expect the expenditures to happen in 11. And on Dulles the rail side, Dulles didn't change. It was just the timing of sending the funding to the airports authority. The bonds, the $125 million of bonds that was allocated to that project, we had sent $73.6 million, and they hadn't spent those funds completely. So even though we issued the financing for those bond allocations in May, until they're ready to utilize those funds, we're not going to be sending them. So that's going to happen sometime during 2011. And on the rail side, we've advanced the VTA 2000 funds, the six MOU projects, pretty much to completion to where there's really just a very tiny amount of those funds left now. So there's a slight decrease there. And finally, last thing I want to talk about is our administrative budget. We get $4.9 million of the cost for us to manage our projects and administer our processes from the highway, the HMO program. And then also 2 years ago, we were given in the Appropriation Act the ability to take up to 3% off the top of those three funds I spoke of earlier, the Rail Enhancement, Rail Preservation, and the Mass Transit Trust Fund, in order to also allow us to fund the cost of project management compliance administration. So in the current year, that adds up to 2.5% or $3.9 million. Couple that with the HMO support, we're at $8.8 million. It's the same total as the original 2010. We did take a one-time cut in December of 10%, but we're back to where we were originally.
And overall, if you remove the Dulles slice from that pie that I showed earlier, these costs amount to 2.2%. And if I left Dulles into that calculation, it would only show a smaller percentage. Obviously, the base would be getting bigger. And this is, once again, because the 2.5% off the top is, we do have to have y'all's approval for this. So this is a list, as we've promised y'all in the past, that we'd always provide. And there's even further detail back in the back of the budget on these expenditures in one of the footnotes. But these are, in general, the activities that we're going to undertake, and they're very similar with past years. You know, the asset management process, transit development plan process, our state safety and facility oversight programs, which funds the oversight program with WMATA and now with the Norfolk Light Rail system that the state is responsible for, and also provides funding for the technical consulting expertise that our agency needs. And finally, the last slide is a mirror to the expenditure slide, and this just tells you all where the funding is actually coming from to cover that $465 million of cash outlay. And that concludes. I'll answer any questions.
Excellent. Any discussion? Questions? Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Going to get to the Norfolk Light Rail. Adam, Jack.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, good afternoon. My name is Adam Jack. I'm the Assistant District Administrator in Hampton Roads for Engineering and Investment. And I'm very excited to be here, actually. It's been a long morning, and I'm here to end your work session with, I think, a really positive note, and that is the Norfolk Light Rail project, which is ready to, for all intents and purposes, start testing vehicles. The project begins in the downtown Norfolk area and comes by City Hall and then starts paralleling the Interstate 264 corridor. Associated with that, as we've worked with this 100-year-old railway corridor that's being converted over to light rail, we started running into some involvement with HRT in the city of Norfolk, who I would add Mr. Paul Fillion from the assistant city manager, as well as Mr. John Kuiper, the special assistant city manager for light rail, are here with me today. We ran into some issues that we needed to go ahead and coordinate, particularly the way the interstate and the railroad intertwined in all of the existing rights that were associated with the 100-year-old railway. So as part of that, we started to enter into a discussion about what the agreement should be between HRT and VDOT, or the city of Norfolk, since they're the initial owner of the property, as to how we should work those agreements or how we should operate. Initially, we started on a land use permit process, and we started talking about the encroachment areas and the areas that we would be sharing, who would have responsibilities. Ultimately, HRT bears all the cost of that, and the agreement that we've crafted, which is in front of you this afternoon, provides for VDOT and HRT to do improvements along that corridor in a much more cooperative manner rather than the standard railroad slash VDOT agreement, if you will. It also clearly designates maintenance procedures, HRT coordinating with us as they operate in and around particularly our bridges that go over their corridor and the overhead electrical systems and those types of stuff, and as well for us, insurance and other types of elements that are important as we operate next to a railway corridor that's electrified. We reviewed the MOA, the Memorandum of Agreement, that is in front of you, with all the internal folks. The one agency that's not on this list is FHWA. FHWA has reviewed the Memorandum of Agreement and concurs and is in support of that agreement. that's the first portion of what you will hear this afternoon. The second portion that we will be asking for is a limited access control change. This came about with a change in leadership at HRT when former Commissioner Chiquette came on board there, and we started talking about how to operate a light rail system which encroached onto an interstate, into an interstate area, and we came to the realization that it would be in their best interest as well as ours to make sure that the limited access line for Interstate 264 was outside of any areas that we needed to share in regards to maintenance and operations. And that's why this, essentially, that's why this is before you. And what it does is it shifts the limited access line in certain locations to be outside of those shared areas, in addition to clarifying those old railroad and city street agreements that we had, that we've had in place for 100 years, just to clarify our positions. I've provided in this presentation a series of index maps for you. Light rail, and this is the light rail system as it intertwines with Interstate 264. On the left is the west, on the right is the east, where we pass underneath the areas in red are where the light rail system passes underneath of our interstate facilities, either on existing right-of-way or easements. It continues parallel to Interstate 264 on the following on Sheet 2, past Norfolk State University, or up to Norfolk State University. Sheet 3, Norfolk State University is to the immediate north. The maintenance facility for HRT will be at the Brambleton Interchange, which is to the left on that drawing. Sheet 4, also same type situation, shifting that limited access control line actually out of those shared areas. Another bridge crossing to be dealt with there. Sheet 5, same thing. And ultimately, on Sheet 7, the one area that's really a little bit that will come before you next month should you pass this these requests. There's a large chunk of area next to an overpass on the interstate that that the city of Norfolk and HRT would like to have for a ride park and ride facility there at the interstate. And then the one blow up at the 264 interchange and how, again, an area that we're modifying the limited access so that the terms and conditions of maintenance and operations are very clear. Again, what you will be asked this afternoon is to look at this, enter into a, allow the commissioner of the Virginia Department of Transportation to enter into the memorandum of agreement, as well as approving the limited access control changes. And with that, sir, I'd entertain any questions.
Excellent. Any questions?
Thank you very
much. This will be an action item on our agenda.
Yes, sir.
Great. All right, well, thank you very much. This will close out our work session. We will now gavel.